Hey everyone, welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this is a bit of a bonus episode. I was in Prince Edward County. This is part of the Prince Edward County winemaker series that I've been putting out. And I was at Grange to interview winemaker owner Caroline Granger. And I was going to talk to her a bunch about her daughter, Maggie, and just the role that Maggie has with the winery and what was it like working with your daughter and all that kind of thing. And I got there a couple minutes early. Maggie was around. Carolyn wasn't. Caroline decided, hey, Maggie, you want to talk for a couple minutes? And she was like, sure. And I honestly thought this was going to be about a 3-4 minute conversation. And then her mom would step in and just move on with the normal interview. Instead, it ended up being close to 40 minutes. And it was great. And Maggie has some crazy stories about level 3 droughts, about crops that were wiped out in 2015, her own childhood, her own way of rebelling as a teenager. Her passion for making great grapes is all over the place in this interview. It's really good. Like, this is totally unexpected. A lot of energy, a lot of passion, a lot of intelligence. I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. A little bit later this week or next week, you'll hear from Caroline Granger. But for now, it's her daughter. It's pretty good. Here's Maggie Granger.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm going to be interviewing Caroline Granger from Granger, the Grange Winery here in Prince Edward County. But we're going in a different direction because part of the interview I was going to do was about her relationship with her daughter, Maggie, who's been a big part of this vineyard pretty much since its inception. And Maggie was here first. So, Maggie, thank you so much for giving some dirt on your mom before I talk to your mom.
Absolutely. That's always my pleasure.
So let's get to the most important stuff. What does it say about the beauty of this vineyard when a Hallmark movie was filmed at this vineyard?
Oh my gosh. Well, that experience was just totally surreal.
And what was the cheesy title? Not saying the movie isn't going to be wonderful and up for every Oscar, no, but what was the title?
Be prepared for the cheese. So it's called My Secret Valentine. Yeah. No, it was great. It all happened in such like a whirlwind way as well. They scouted the place and 10 days later they took over. It was like 10 trucks and they took over every space. The whole tasting room was shut down for a week and Tiffany lamps were put up. And
so what was craft service like? What was the food like?
I mean, I couldn't say no to craft services.
No one says no to craft services. It's so crazy. Actors who always have to try to be skinny and yet they're surrounded by food.
Oh, yeah. I had poutine for breakfast on multiple occasions.
So let me ask you this. What of the wines of Grange best paired with the craft service, the food at craft service?
That's a good question. I think you probably couldn't go wrong with the poutine and a Pinot Noir. A little high-low there for you.
I like
pretty
it.
Pretty nice.
So you getting into the biz, what are some of your earliest memories of wine, of Prince Edward County wine?
Oh, that's really interesting. Well, I will say, I mean, I remember planting the vineyards, right? I was really interested in...
How old were you?
I would have been 13. And so I remember, you know, there was this thing in the backyard that was taking up all of my mom's attention, and I wasn't sure how much I really loved that. And so I'd be out there scoping it out and seeing what was happening and watching the equipment plant these vines. But we were a small team. It was just really my mom at that point doing all the work. And it's hard to watch her work all the time and not help. And so inadvertently, I just go out in the field with her and start tamping down the soil around the vines and help keep them standing. And I think one of the most memorable things was that year, the first year we planted, there was a crazy drought here. It was a level 3 drought. It was already...
What does that mean for people listening, a level 3 drought?
There was just no water. So we planted May long weekend. In 2001.
How old were you then?
I was 13 that
13.
Year.
Yeah. Okay, 13, sorry. Yeah.
And it had rained maybe the Mother's Day weekend, so just before then. But that was the last rain for 9 weeks. And so we're going through this drought, and these vines need water to start to take. They have no root system whatsoever.
Yeah.
And so what we had to do is we had to create this like makeshift tanker on the back of the tractor filled with water. It had two hoses off the back, and so the hoses would just pour water out, and in order for us to not waste water, we had to drop the hose right at the base of the vine, flip it up, and then drop it to the next vine, but you had to do this at the pace of the tractor. So you had to learn how to walk and pace and keep up. And I will tell you, after a few vines, you get a little tired. You start tripping over your feet trying to keep up.
And you probably felt pressure. It's like, I'm 13. I'm trying to help my mom. There's been no rain. And if I screw up, then the plants are going to die.
Everything's going to die. Absolutely. Yeah, oh, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It was definitely surreal.
Very scientific. Yeah. Very scientific. Just getting the tractor with two hoses.
I know exactly. That's it, right? Yeah. You just figure out what you have to do when you're in a new wine region, right?
And for you, like, did it just come naturally that, like, you wanted to be in the wine? Because this feels like the stereotype, you know, the following in your parents' footstep, going into the, you know, because you were telling me, like, you've worked here for so many of your formative years. Was this, mm-hmm. like, at what point did you realize this is what you want to do?
So in some ways,
and by the way, you're young. I mean, this is what you want to do right now.
Yeah.
Who knows what it's going to be at 10 years
from
now?
Oh, we'll see. I think I'm pretty hooked at this point.
Yeah.
But as a kid, in my early teens, I loved it. I loved being outside. I loved working with the vines. I felt like that was really, really beautiful. But by the time I hit 16, 17, 18.
Rebellious? Did you have your rebellious teen years?
I did.
Wait a minute. Sorry to interrupt. To me, my idea of being a rebellious teen in this family is all you're doing is drinking Yellowtail.
Oh, my God.
It's like, whatever, Mom. Not enough sugar in your wines.
Oh, my God.
Wait a minute, Mom. Organic, natural? This thing is filtered, fine, and it's got a whole lot of sugar.
Okay, I didn't do that, but I did tell my mom that I was sort of leaving the farm. I didn't want to be a farmer. I wanted to go live in the city and have a manicure and have a desk job and all that sort of stuff. And so when I applied to university, I applied to sort of do a pre-law program at McGill, which has absolutely nothing to do with like wine or wine culture, right?
I mean, at least if you studied law, it's like Guelph.
Know,
at least you would have felt somewhat close.
That's right. Yeah. No, I went like the other way, the other direction. And I was taking like ancient political theory and cultural studies and sociology, right? I was making sure that nothing really applied to business or science or anything that they could tie back in.
So then how'd you get tied back in?
Well, so it turns out in these cultural studies programs, I was in these classes with students who had grown up in the city, who had this like real engagement with pop culture, with film, with art, with theater, and they were able to use their experience for these cultural studies programs and apply, you know, whether it was like Marxist commodification, globalization in the economies, things like this that we were talking about in our courses. I, however, you know, was a bit of a country bumpkin and really didn't have that experience. And so when I went to write these papers on a topic that I knew, well, I knew about wine and how that was produced and the industry and the culture around it. And so I ended up writing all these papers about wine and wine culture. And
you got sucked back in.
I did get sucked back in. Yeah. It doesn't hurt that Montreal, you know, this was 10 years ago, had the best natural wine, low intervention wine scene in Canada.
Much better back then than in Toronto.
Yeah, it's just a whole different ballgame now. Like it's definitely an equal playing field. But back then, it was really my first experience with those kinds of wines. And those were the things that made me excited to come back and be involved.
Curious thinking about this. And I mean, it would be more common growing up here, but when you talk to other people, did you have a unique experience growing up where weather had a much bigger impact for you? Because like, if you're a city person, I grew up in Toronto, if it didn't rain for 6 weeks, I was like, hooray, that's awesome.
Yeah,
if sure. there was suddenly frost in May, I was just bummed out because maybe I can't go into a swimming pool. But the stakes are very different growing up making wine. Like, were you even at a young age, did weather have a bigger impact on you emotionally than it would other people around you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to this day, I can still recall, you know, the weather and climactic trends from the last like 15 years, right? You just like have it seared into your brain. Every vintage, you have a strong understanding of what it was like and the significance of it. But I will say that Canadians, as opposed to anybody else, like, we small talk about the weather, but it really impacts our lives,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Harsh winters, super hot summers, like... I think as a culture, we're all kind of, we live and breathe around the weather that we're experiencing.
But the stakes are a lot higher for you
higher
than when
me.
I'm bitching about it, getting my hair cut, about how it's been cold the last couple of days.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
So then what are your most memorable vintages in terms of ones where just everything went as smoothly as could possibly happen at a vineyard, and nothing is ever 100% smooth.
Yeah.
And the ones that, you know, that you have some, you know, PTSD still thinking about them.
For sure. Well, let's talk about two vintages in a row. So 2015 was a significant year in Prince Edward County, and I don't think any county producers will really ever forget that year.
Yeah. The frost.
Exactly. But it started out as the most beautiful spring. We had had a mild winter and an early spring. Everyone was absolutely loving life. We were all so optimistic. By the end of May, we had four leaves already growing on the vines, which is a lot, folks, for anyone who isn't a vineyard geek, to have a full sort of set of leaves by that time. It's early, yeah. And we were feeling very optimistic about the fruit that we were going to produce. I had friends out, and I was doing a vineyard tour 2 days before this frost that I'm getting to, and I was like, look at how much fruit potential is out here. It's
yeah.
just amazing. And then we get a little notice on the weather app that says frost warning. And I remember talking to some of my neighbors out here and other wine growers, and they said to me, like, Maggie, it's impossible. It's not going to happen. There's no way. We're like a week past the frost.
This is
deadline.
Like Titanic. This is like the captain of the Titanic said, there's no icebergs. This is the largest ship ever. We're fine.
Truly.
Yeah.
And nonetheless, we went out to the vineyard that night, and we made sure the fans, our inversion fans, were prepped and ready to go. And we're like, well, if we lose sleep for one night for nothing, it's no big deal. And if we're out here, maybe we can, you know, make the difference in the vineyard. And so most of the night we went through fine. It was 3-4 in the morning. It was still fine. It was still above zero. But at like 5 in the morning, right when you started to see like the first of the sun coming up, which is usually when you think you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
That's when the temperature started to absolutely plummet. And it was, you know, 1 degree, 0, -1, -2. And you're like, wow, this isn't even just like a frost,
that's
right?
Scary.
Like a -2. It's like a polar vortex for that time of year, right? It went down to -5.5 on this farm. And we're running all of our inversion fans, but the problem is, at that time of year, you just don't have a 5.5 degree inversion. We had about a 3.5 degree inversion. So we were still stuck at -2.
Right.
And no matter how you swing the back, you're frozen at that temperature.
Yeah.
And so we went from four beautiful, bright green leaves. Once the sun came up that day, it was all black.
How much you lose?
We lost on this farm 75% of the production.
Ugh. Like, it's funny. The only one that got it worse was where I did my last interview. I was at Rose Hall Run.
Yeah.
Dan Sullivan, they lost 100%.
Yeah, they didn't
make
any.
But 75%, that is devastating.
Absolutely.
That is, yeah. By the way, that is a wild story.
Oh, it's crazy. Just to have experienced it and to see, you know, I was standing at the, in their Victoria block, which faces the Clausen Road, and many of my neighboring vineyard owners, winemakers were all driving down the road, and they all stopped, and everyone were giving each other big hugs, right? Like,
yeah.
it's a really sad moment.
Jesus. Yeah. And then, I mean, it must have been scary because you have no control. You know, it's a bit of hyperbole, but it's almost like you are on a boat in the middle of the ocean. You have no control as the waves are just crashing down on you. You're just, at that point, you're just helpless to Mother Nature.
Absolutely. She's the boss. And I think we all have to remember that. I think we all have to remember, though, as well, if it was easy to grow grapes, everyone would do it.
Yeah.
And if it was always easy, you know, these wines would be $2 a bottle,
yeah,
right? The reason these wines are valuable and they're rare and we spend so much time to make such beautiful wines is because it is hard to grow these grapes and they're worth taking the time to make really great grapes.
So what is your role here at Grange?
So I do a little bit of everything, mm-hmm, except for accounting.
Okay, smart.
Not allowed to touch the numbers.
Yeah.
But I work out in the vineyards, and I oversee our integrated pest management program, which allows us to be low intervention in the vineyards. Mm-hmm. So I'm out there all the time monitoring, observing, and making judgment calls to protect the vineyard, but also to protect the environment. So
yeah,
I think about it in the terms of what needs to be done and what needs to not be done in the vineyard. So it's a bit of a complicated job. Yeah, I run the tasting room and the hospitality program, marketing, sales. If anybody loves the beautiful new labels that we have, I was so grateful to work with a wonderful team to make those. But yeah, that was a bit of my baby as well.
So you're busy.
Yeah, I try to keep busy. That's right. Yes.
Yeah, you're very busy.
Absolutely,
yeah,
for sure.
How much pressure do you feel when you're out in the vineyards and you're making decisions and calls on, you know, as you say, about just some of the viticulture involved? Because, you know, there's acres and acres and acres of grapes, and you're making those calls. I mean, obviously, mm-hmm, you've done it long enough, so you feel confident, and you guys have a long track record of success. But
yeah,
you know, that do you still feel any pressure?
Absolutely. The vineyard is everything to us. So we are 100% estate-grown production. So if we don't grow it, we don't get to make it. And mm-hmm, so that is, it's really the most essential part of what we're doing. It's our biggest investment every year, in terms of our energy, our time, and our money is in the vineyard. And so it's huge for us. It's also incredibly varied. Everything is always changing in the vineyard, and it's hard to come back from bad calls in the vineyard.
Right,
one bad call and you can really you know.
And you're not going to try to correct any mistake with, you know, like, we're going to add more sugar, or we're going to get these yeasts, or, you know, we're going to acidify, like all these tricks and things you can do. For you guys and your ethos, those are not methods you guys are going to use.
No, exactly. They're out of the question. So instead, what we do is we look at the fruit, and we decide what the best course for the final product is in the moment. So we almost have no idea what kind of wine we're going to make that year until the fruit is in the building.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you make calls and you go, oh, it's a hot year, it's going to be a little riper, I think I want to make these styles. But until that fruit is physically in your door, you have no idea what Mother Nature is actually going to give you. And in fact, I've had a plan for wines. And we go into the fermentation with one plan, and then we taste the wine during the fermentation and post-fermentation, I'm like, no, it's completely different. It just wants to be something else. And I like having the flexibility to be able to let the wine be what it wants to be.
So we're going to get off viticulture and vinification for a second. When you go out for dinner with friends, are you the one that has to order the wine?
There are a few friends, mm-hmm, that I will defer to, but they are a very small group of people.
Yeah.
Otherwise, yeah, I will be the one to buy the wine.
Do you feel pressure because you don't know what everyone's going to like? And I imagine you might spend a little bit more on wine because it's part of your culture, and you probably spend less money on maybe technology or cars or art or other things. So do you feel pressure when you're ordering the wine?
Yeah, I think we all agree upon a budget.
Okay,
right,
that's smart.
That one's the one. So yep, they give me a top end number. I usually will hit that top end.
Yeah. If someone says, Maggie, we can't go over 100,
yeah, exactly,
then it's
like
95, or it's like it's 108. It's like it's only $8
that's right,
more.
I'll pay the extra $8.
Yeah.
It's going to be totally worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So I like to. I never want to make somebody pay more than they're comfortable with. But honestly, most of the bottles I really love are between like $70 and $85 on a list. Yeah. I'm a Gamay drinker. I love Aligoté.
It's good if you love Gamay. If you love Gamay, that will help the wallet.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's one of my favorites that we grow and make, but it's one of my favorites in the world.
It is, and it's done really well here. Absolutely. Gamay is made. It's made great here. It's made great in Niagara.
Yeah.
You know, you guys do fantastic stuff in Niagara, 13th Street. I mean, there's tons. Yeah, there's tons of great Gamay. Okay, so I don't even know if this applies, but people come to your place for dinner.
Okay.
And they bring you a bottle of wine.
Uh-huh.
How much do they apologize as they're giving you the bottle, going, I hope this is okay?
Oh, my God.
What is the sheepish level when someone comes to your home and brings a bottle of wine?
I love it. You know what? I will say that I usually will tell somebody to bring a dish rather than a bottle of wine.
Yeah.
because I do feel for folks. Yeah. But I will, the one anecdote I can tell you is that in university, when we used to have house parties, which, you know, it wasn't all about studying all the time. Sometimes we'd have a little get together.
Yes.
And people would bring wine. If they brought the wrong wine, I would trade them for one of my wines. So I would say, hey, how about we drink this one instead?
Yeah.
And at the end of the year, I'd have a case or two of these terrible bottles of wine.
All right, dish the dirt. What were some of those bottles?
Oh, my goodness.
You know, I know you remember.
Okay, I remember. Yeah. But we're talking about those, like, mass producers, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not my neighbors making things that are in a different style than mine. It's not another Ontario producer.
It's South
These are
America,
like, exactly.
Australia,
you got it. The big stuff, like, right. God knows where it's from.
There's a critter on the bottle.
You betcha.
Okay.
You're
so polite. You don't want to say the name.
But I would take all that wine and we'd do like a big sangria party at the end of the year.
That is a fantastic idea.
See?
Good for you. That is great. So now the other side, you go to a party and you bring the bottle of wine.
Uh-huh.
How much more reverence does everyone have when Maggie Granger arrives with a bottle of wine? Everyone's like, oh, this is the one we must open, and all the other bottles are cast aside.
Oh, I don't know about that, actually. I think all of my friends love the wines they love, and they're proud of the wines they love if they love it. And I would never tell somebody to, like, feel bad about something that
I'm
they brought.
No, I'm not telling you. I'm not saying you do it. I'm talking about the people when you arrive, that there's going to be a higher level of deference for what you bring.
Okay. So,
and you're not being, I'm not making you all out to be egotistical or anything this.
Okay.
It's just the nature of that. I know these are jokey things, but it goes to the nature of there is a level of insecurity when it comes to wine. You are an authority. You've worked on it in your whole life. I mean, my God, what you've accomplished and done by your age is damn impressive. And so people can naturally feel insecure. So then the bottle you bring, it's like the Ark of the Covenant. I don't even know if you get that reference because you're about 10, 12 years younger than me.
No way. I love indie.
Okay. Just checking.
No, so I will say that my bottle would probably be drank early in the night.
Yours isn't the late night, we're drunk, but we still want one. Yeah, you're not last bottle.
No, but my friends are all folks who would never leave a bottle behind.
Yeah,
we're all good folks.
You're like Marines. No soldiers left behind.
No, exactly. Yeah, for sure. So everything's gonna serve a purpose in the night.
Did you have a bottle? Was there a bottle that really, and it could be from here, from this winery, or Prince Edward, Ontario, or maybe somewhere else in the world. Was there a bottle where you tried it and you're like, oh, I get this. I now get why people are passionate, and damn, this bottle is really doing something for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I had the pleasure of being able to go to Burgundy and to Chablis and taste with producers. I went to François Ravineau.
Oh, you got some Chablis.
Yes. And those wines are like some of the most beautiful wines I've ever had.
Yeah.
And,
you don't have any here right now, do you?
Oh, in this building? Yeah. No, I keep those locked away at home.
Smart.
For sure. Yeah.
And your home again is where? Okay, so so Ravineau, Chablis. Yeah.
It's just like so iconic. And so for a region that's like based around Chardonnay, as we are here, seeing like the majesty of these wines was so inspiring and really humbling.
How?
In what ways is here Grange and you know some of the better producers in Prince Edward County? In what ways are you guys similar to Burgundy, and what are the main differences?
So these are really good questions.
Now, is it a really good question, or are you stalling for a second to think of the answer?
No, so I wanna reference this conversation I had with another Chablis producer. The domain is Louis Michel, and it's the grandson, Guillaume Michel, who's the winemaker, and he and I were at the same table at Raspivhav in Montreal a few years ago, and we were pouring our wines, and we were talking to each other, and one of the things, you know, I said to him was that I love Chablis so much. I'm so inspired that their wines are so incredible, and that I just like wish I could do something half as amazing as those wines. And he said back to me, he's like, but Maggie, you also have something so special. I can only make the wines I'm making, and I can only make them in the style that I'm making now.
Right,
there's
the rules.
So much, yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's so many rules. There's so much tradition.
Yeah.
There's just really no place to explore. He's like, you get to grow whatever varietals you want. You get to make them however you want. Like, that is so special, and you're so lucky, and I almost died, right? Like,
yeah.
to have a producer you admire so much say
that
to you is really amazing.
How much insecurity do you think we have here when we try to compare ourselves, like, or almost all shucks, when we try to compare ourselves to Burgundy? And listen, Burgundy's had the advantage of hundreds and hundreds of years head start, so their vine age are much older. They've plotted, mapped out every square inch of soil, so they near, you know, the Grand Cru is here, and then you throw a football, and you've already passed the Premier Cru. You're now at the Village level.
Yeah.
You know, but, like, do you think there's a insecurity level among the producers? It's like, well, we can't be Burgundy. When a lot of cases, the Chardonnay's here, the Pinot's here, they match up against Burgundy.
Absolutely. And I will say there's certain producers that would have no trouble comparing themselves to Burgundy here. I hear it all the time.
Name the producers that maybe compare themselves a little too much to Burgundy.
Yes, I think we can all think of a couple, hey?
Yeah.
I don't want to necessarily be Burgundy.
Yeah.
Right? They've been being Burgundy for 1,000 years,
yep.
And they are the best at being Burgundy, right?
Yeah.
They're Burgundy.
They're very good at it.
Yeah, exactly. They nailed that one on the head. I want to be something else. I want to do something unique. I want to tell my own story. And so I almost don't want my wine to be like Burgundy or as good as Burgundy. I want it to be something totally different and inspiring in like a completely different way.
How would you define Maggie Granger wine?
Okay, that's a good question. Weird, for sure.
I feel like I'm Barbara Walters right now. It's like, you know, just but you know, you're fascinating. I most of my research has been on your mom, but it means I read up about you here or there. So, you know, or not even what it is right now, or you can answer it like that. Also, what do you want your wines to be?
So for me, the things that I take the most pride in my wines are unique flavor profiles. I don't want to feel boxed in by any sort of like stigma or any sort of varietal typicity that I feel like I need to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to say what is regional typicity for Prince Edward County, the only things I really want to see is great acidity and great minerality. Otherwise, I think it's anything goes.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make wines that I basically have to do nothing to. So I want to be a lazy winemaker.
No such thing.
No, but I mean, like, I want
to be a non-interventionist. But wouldn't it be fair to say that to be a non-interventionist in the winery means you're working really hard in the vineyard?
Absolutely, for sure.
Yeah.
And that's what we do here, definitely.
Yeah.
I just want to spend all my time learning about what makes the vineyard thrive, how we can integrate these vineyards into the larger environment that we have on this farm, right? We have 60 acres of vineyards, but we have a 600 acre farm. So like, how do you integrate that in so it's like a cohesive unit and it's all healthy and thriving together? So through that work, when I bring that into the wine at the end of the day, I want these wines to taste like juicy and alive. and yeah, to have a personality.
So you push back a little on topicity, and I get it, because you know the idea of everything having to be structured is mm-hmm. it's not something you want.
Yeah.
I think being a winemaker means you're part artist. Mm-hmm. So then structure is often the enemy of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
But for the marketing or selling of Prince Edward County wine, is it important to really promote and hammer down the different typicity, much the same way in Burgundy? Chablis doesn't taste like Meursault. Meursault doesn't taste like Poulinet Montrachet, which doesn't, and you can go on and on about just the different regions. And like I tried to Clos and Chase, and I tried two of their Pinots, mm-hmm. one on one side of the road, one on the other, they tasted different. I'm like, that's great. Yeah, that's a great story to sell. Is that important for just continuing to push Prince Edward County on Ontario and on the world, that if you try a Prince Edward County wine that is now hillier, it's going to be different than if it's one southern, closer to the water, you know, by Long Dog, for instance?
For sure. I think there is definitely some value in that. The other thing that I think is going to become more important in this region in the long term when we're sort of defining ourselves is the varietals that we choose. Right now, as you tour around the county, there are dozens of grape varietals being grown here. I myself have 7 varietals on this farm.
What are they? What do you got?
So Chardonnay, Riesling, Pinot Gris. And just a teeny, teeny, tiny planting of Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
And then Gamay, Pinot Noir, and Cabernet Franc.
Right.
Right? So that's a lot.
That's a lot.
And then beyond that, there's Italian varietals. There's Spanish varietals here. There's...
I tried a Tempranillo earlier today.
Yeah, exactly. There's a Gruner Veltliner down in the South End. So...
Kenty, I think, does a Chenin Blanc.
Yeah, exactly. There's a few of those. And so I think that maybe... as we all grow and mature and we settle into our styles, we can settle into varietals, but maybe not. Maybe we're going to be the land of the like weirdo artisans, right? And Prince Edward County will always be known for like these outliers, right?
Yeah.
I don't mind that. Niagara is very, it's very consistent. The quality is very consistent. The varietals are very consistent. The styles of winemaking are very consistent. And maybe that's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe we just do what we want.
There always has to be room for outliers.
Yeah, like, can we be the like weird little brother that's
well, you
like
guys
a little
are.
More
like
creative?
Some of your your skin contact, your Pinot Gris, like you know, you do stuff that is a little bit different.
Yeah.
Same thing with your sparklings. I think for me, in a perfect world, and this is my selfishness, because I'm a selfish fella. What I want from Prince Edward County is I want killer Pinot and killer Chard. Can be done in different styles.
Yeah.
Can be, you know, the Chablis style versus the Meursault style. And the same thing with my Pinot. Sometimes light, sometimes, you know, more power, more muscle. Not some of the Sonoma where it's like, I don't want 15% alcohol in my Pinot.
And 6 grams of sugar.
Oh, by the way, like Miomi?
Yeah.
Shame on you. I know you can't comment on it. You're the nice one. But Miomi, shame on you.
Oh, my goodness.
You know I'm right.
Yeah.
Blink twice. But I what I want from Prince Edward is always, I always want to know, I'm going to get great different styles of Pinot and Chard, and then I want to know there are the avant-garde winemakers out there making Tempranillo, you know. And by the way, I don't even think of I think of Sauvignon Blanc is a little bit out there.
For sure.
I don't try a lot of Prince Edward Riesling, but like, you know, plenty of good Gamay, plenty of good Cab Franc. Mm-hmm. I think of those grapes here. But yeah, I think that's what I'd want from Prince Edward County. Give me some of my conservative things, but then give me a nice little artistic underbelly as well.
I love that. Yeah, I think that sounds great.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get everybody on board.
All right. We're going to end this with, by this fun. I thought this was like literally, I was going to bring you on for 4 or 5 minutes.
I know.
Are you okay? Has this been okay for you?
This is great.
Because I've been peppering you with like 1,000 questions.
No, it's perfect.
Okay.
It's made me use my brain. I love it.
Okay. Okay. Well, you're a winemaker. You use your brain all the time.
Hey, sometimes.
This is the simple, easy question. You know, I ask it almost of all winemakers. But you're a little bit younger than a lot of the ones I interview. Not that everyone's interviewing is like 70, you know. But where would you like to see yourself in 10 years from now? I'll ask you like this. Big picture, where do you see yourself in 10 years? Smaller picture, what's one grape that maybe you're making or that you want to make? One grape that you're rooting for?
Oh, okay. I love both those questions. I mean, we've already talked about Gamay, but it's always going to be my baby here. Mm-hmm. I love it so much. I can't believe that my mom had the foresight to plant so much Gamay 20 years ago when it was still a Cabernet world.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point, because people that grow Gamay now, it's like, yeah, it's all out there. But in 2000...
No, it really wasn't.
Too much Cabernet
in
Ontario.
Yes, absolutely.
Too much Cabernet. It's one of the reasons why Ontario wines were bad, or like, not bad. The quality wasn't there because there's too much Cabernet in a land that shouldn't have Cabernet.
That's right, right? Yeah. Like, leave the Cabs to the Californians, right?
Yeah.
We can do something else and we can do it better.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that ultimately is what I want to do, is I want to be here. I want to be doing what I'm doing, but I want to spend the next year, 10 years learning what thrives, what works, how to make everything healthier, more abundant, more sustainable, and really just have it all sort of settle into place.
Yeah. Maggie, really appreciate it. This was impromptu. This was not planned. Your story of the 2015 frost, that was fantastic.
Oh, my God. Yeah, we'll never forget.
Yeah,
hey.
Yeah. And thank you again for doing this. And congratulations on the winery success. Congratulations on your success. Mm-hmm. And by the way, because now this is going to be its own separate pod. Okay. My original thought was, okay, this will be a little five-minute little appetizer before your mom. So this is its own separate podcast. So promote. Where can people find your wines, websites, all that sort of stuff?
Okay, for sure. So I would say Instagram, everybody. That's where all of the information is at. So Grange Winery on Instagram. We also have a couple of beautiful wines in the LCBO. So if you're looking for real 100% Prince Edward County grown wine, we have Almanac White and Red in the LCBO. It's under $20. It's delicious. So
under $20 Prince Edward. That's hard.
Right?
That is hard. One thing I can talk to your mom about is how Ontario doesn't make it easy to make wines for inexpensive prices.
No kidding. No. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I got the LCBO and you guys, you know, it's not hard to find. Get the Prince Edward County and just Google Grange Winery and it's able to find it. And it's gorgeous. It's so nice. It's so nice that they made a Hallmark movie here. Called, what was the title again?
My Secret Valentine.
My Secret Valentine. Something tells me by the end there's probably very few secrets. Maggie, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks everyone for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, rate, subscribe, download, tell your friends, tell your enemies. You can find me on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Audioboom, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.